17 seconds and counting. Guidance internal. 15, 14, 13, 12, 11, 10, 9. We have ignition sequence start. Engines on. 5, 4, 3, 2. All engines running.
Because that challenge is one that we're willing to accept, one we are willing to control, and one we intend to win.
Okay, engine stop. ATA at a descent. Air control mode auto, descent engine command override off. Engine arm on. 413 is in.
We got to get down, Eagle.
Houston, Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
Today on Cosmic Perspective Radio, my guest is a longtime adventure journalist. He's the author of The Right Stuff, interviews with icons of the 1960s. He has skied to the South Pole, visited the North Pole twice, driven a Bugatti Veyron at a top speed of 253 miles per hour, flown in a Russian MiG to the edge of space, and is a ticket holder on Virgin Galactic Spaceship Two's suborbital flight into space. Jim Clash, welcome, and thanks for joining us again on Cosmic Perspective Radio.
Andy, it's always great to be on Cosmic Perspectives.
Last time you were here, we spoke about you being shot at a close range with a bulletproof vest and your experience as a rodeo bullfighter, and I can't wait to hear your next experiences. You had an experience at an Air Force event at the U.S. Pentagon that led you to a series of adventures.
Yeah, the Pentagon had a special press day, and they invited some of us to come down. I'd never been to the Pentagon, so I thought this would be great, just to visit the Pentagon. But during the course of the day, they had different panels. One panel was about flying F-15s. Another panel was about space launches. Another panel was about missileers who actually have their hands on the keys that launch the missiles. And at the end of the day, they asked if there was anything we would be interested in as reporters to do. And of course, I was like, sign me up for all of them, you know. With the F-15, I had to fly down to North Carolina to one of the bases there. And they trained me with parachute and ejection seat maneuvers. And then we went up in an F-15 and went supersonic, Mach 1.1. And it was just my fourth time being supersonic, but the first time I had been in an American plane. And it was a kick in the butt.
I understand that you went up to 6 Gs at one time?
Oh, yeah. So what happened was, you know, when we got up to about 30,000 feet, the pilot wanted to test my tolerance for Gs. 1 G is one time your body weight. 6 Gs is six times your body weight. So he took me on a couple of maneuvers. And the first maneuver, we went into a turn, and he pulled about 4 Gs. And, you know, you can feel that. I've done some G training, but in an airplane, you really feel it because you tend to get motion sickness. And after that, he said, you want to go to 6? And I said, okay, let's go to 6 Gs. So I knew 6 Gs. I'd done it in the centrifuge. And sure enough, we pulled 6 Gs, and I was starting to get a little queasy. So I just said, you know, I think, he said, sure, you don't want to go to 9 Gs? I think I reached my limit. I think 6 Gs is fine. So I kept it together. But the reality is these guys, they fly at 9 Gs, and they're able to somehow focus on what they have to do without getting sick. And it's just, I find it amazing, just amazing.
You had mentioned that you started to lose your peripheral vision a bit and your breathing was difficult. And I just can't imagine, that's at 6 Gs, and I just can't imagine that these pilots do this, you know, day in and day out. How do they do it?
Well, a couple of things. One is you do maneuvers that keep the blood in your head. There's a something called Heck breathing where you tense up your glute muscles and your stomach muscles to keep the blood flowing in your head. Also, we had on G-suits, which are pressure suits that inflate in the legs, which also tend to keep the blood, you know, in your upper torso. The way it was explained to me is that the pilots themselves develop a tolerance for G's as they do more and more of this stuff. It's like anything else. Their body gets used to it. The second thing is, I don't know if you've ever driven a car over a certain terrain and then you've ridden over a certain terrain as a passenger. Usually, at least with me, if I'm driving the car, I don't get car sick as much as I do if I'm in the passenger seat. Well, I was in the passenger seat, so I was going to get sick faster than the pilot was, and that's part of it, too. They just are driving the machine, and they're able to perform and whatnot a little better than we are as passengers.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense, and I would think it comes down to muscle memory, too, for them. You know, they've done it, and you had mentioned the same thing about being in the centrifuge, that your first time you said, oh, how am I going to do this? And after a while, you just become accustomed to it.
That's true. I remember the centrifuge, we had 2 days of training. The first day, they gradually built us up to 6 Gs through the chest and 4 Gs through the head, different types of G-forces. And I remember going to bed that night thinking, I don't know if I can do this in a sustained situation. But the next day, there was this little, I guess it was muscle memory, but when I did the simulated Virgin Galactic flight, we pulled 6 Gs for about 30 seconds, and I was fine. But the day before, I don't think I could have done 30 seconds.
One thing I'd like to mention is that you had talked about this bubble and cloud that you got to Mach 1. What's that like?
If you look at the plane from the outside, it's like a lens around the plane. It looks like a cloud, and it's very spectacular looking. But when you're actually inside the plane, what you see as you go from Mach 0.9 to Mach 1, Mach 1.1, is a mist around the plane. And I'm not sure how, if it's something to do with the air pressure, you suddenly go faster than the sound of your plane, and it does something to the air around it. And so for a split second, you feel like you're in a cloud, even though there are no clouds around. And that's what that is. In terms of a feeling of supersonic, when you go supersonic, very, very little feeling. But when you slow down, that sound wave goes by you. And then you feel like a little speed bump, as if you were driving a car and you went over a speed bump. And that, to me, was very interesting. The real feeling of an obstacle is when you slow down, not when you go through the sound barrier.
Yeah. Did you go through any training at all for this at all? You must have some sort of training.
First of all, I had to take a medical exam, pretty thorough, and I was worried that, gee, I'd come all the way down here to fly and they're not going to pass me, but they did. That was my biggest fear. And then we had to learn ejection seat maneuvers. We had to learn how to parachute jump. I've done a parachute jump, but it was only a tandem jump. If something happens, you've got to be able to handle it yourself. For the most part, if something happens in an F-15 and you eject, there is a parachute that deploys on the actual seat. So you don't have that much to do, but you still have to know how to land. There's just a lot of stuff that they make you do in case something happens. And, of course, that scares you because you think, oh, it's probably going to happen. Reality is it only happens once every million flights or something. But they put the fear of God into you, and they should.
And what amazes me is that people that do this day in and day out, this precision that they have, and it's just an amazing thing.
Yeah, you know, I mean, they're special people. There's a reason why they used to call the astronauts the right stuff, fighter pilots the right stuff. My pilot was so cool and calm under pressure, and he was able to joke with me while we were flying, and pulling 6 Gs, he's joking around with me, and I'm thinking, geez, I'm just trying to survive, and this guy's telling jokes, you know. They just really are a special breed of people.
I'd like to talk next about your experience to nuclear missile bunkers and missile sites. That's quite an experience. I'm sure there was a high level of security on a visit like that.
Yeah, so we went out to Minot, North Dakota, where they have a number of missiles in the ground, nuclear missiles. And I actually got to visit the bunker where the guys who have their hands on the keys that turn these things to launch them were housed. So we drove over to one of the silos. There was a giant fence around it, armed guards with machine guns, escorted us into the top part of the bunker, which is a regular house. It has bunk beds in there. It has a restaurant. It has a chef who cooks meals for the soldiers. It has a pool table. You know, there are various amenities there. But then when you go down to the actual bunker, which is 60 feet below the ground, the armed guards put you into an elevator. Now, to get into that elevator, you've got to go through a 13-ton blast door that they have to open. You go into the elevator. They escort you down 60 feet. It's an old sort of a rickety elevator built in the 50s. When you come out, there's another giant blast door they have to open. Once you get that open, you go in to a very cramped area where the two guys are housed who have the keys. And you look in there, and you see the screens and the technology that they're using, and you're just blown away. It's 1950s, Dr. Strangelove type stuff. Two guys that I saw, one was 28, one was 25. These are basically kids, and they're sitting there looking at those screens 24 hours a day. And if some message comes in from the president to launch the missiles, they launch them.
That's a huge weight on their shoulders, the security of the world, basically.
It is. And the other thing is, when we went down, they stripped us of all anything electronic. They took away my tape recorder. They took away my cell phone. They wouldn't allow me to bring a camera down. They had a photographer from the Air Force who took the photos. And, of course, I did an interview with the two missileers, and I had to use the old-fashioned pen and paper method, which I'm not used to anymore. But I asked both of them. I said, you know, if President Trump gave you the order to launch, would you launch? And they said, absolutely. We don't have any politics down here. And it just struck me, made the hair on the back of my neck stand up when I heard that response. I expected that response. I knew they would tell me that. But to hear someone say that in such a definitive way, you realize the whole world, the survival of the world is in these guys' hands, and that the president of the United States can call them up and say, launch the missiles, and they're going to launch them. So we really have to be careful with all these nuclear missiles that we have, that everything is done in a very, very calculated way.
And I understand that other countries are able to visit these missile sites. Is that part of the SALT agreement or one of the agreements?
Yeah, that's true. A lot of people think that because I wrote this story, I was giving away information about where these sites were, et cetera, et cetera. And that's not the case. The case is that China and Russia and the other nuclear powers know exactly where these sites are. And they have to visit them occasionally to make sure that they're complying with the SALT treaties. So I wasn't giving away any information. But to actually go down there and visit them in the bunker themselves, it's just a lot of security, obviously, because, you know, I mean, I don't want to disrupt anything that's going on down there. And certainly I don't want someone coming in there, a rogue person, and trying to launch missiles, correct?
Yeah. Well, one thing I was wondering is what kind of shifts do the missileers do? Are they on 8 on and 8 off, or is it more than one person on at a time? Or?
Well, there's always two people. And they're on 24 hours at a time. So they take them out to the bunker. And they do have inside the bunker a little walled-off area with a curtain where one of the guys can sleep while the other guy is manning the screen. And what happens is, you know, normally nothing comes in of consequence. Obviously, we haven't had a nuclear war. But messages do come across the screen, test messages, things like that. So well, one of them's manning the screen and the other guy's maybe taking a little nap. If something, you know, comes across the screen, the other guy wakes up, the man taking a nap. And so, yeah, it's 24 hours. I did hear a story about a snowstorm out there where they actually couldn't get out to the guy, so they were stuck there for 48 or 72 hours. They had to do a shift for, I think it was 72 hours. And they were very happy to get out of there when the replacement crew came in.
I can imagine being in a hole six stories down for 72 hours.
Yeah, it's not. You know, but the thing is, above ground, they do have these amenities. They have a kitchen and a chef, and you can order. And I ordered a hamburger and a Diet Coke with some fries, and I think it was $1.75. And I did it because I thought, when's the next time I'm going to be in a nuclear missile silo, right?
That's true, and have a hamburger.
Why not? I was hungry.
One picture in your article really hit home for me when I saw this. It kind of gave me a feel for your whole trip. And that is that you had mentioned that if the elevator gets stuck on the way down and they can't get the elevator to work, there's this ladder. It's just a tunnel, and it's a metal ladder, and it's attached to the side of the tunnel, and it's six stories high. And when I look down at this picture, you just look into darkness. It's like an abyss. I mean, is that what would happen if the elevator got stuck? Is that what you'd have to climb up?
Yes, you either have to climb up it or down it, depending upon what happens. And you got to remember, all this stuff, this stuff was built in the 50s. So things happen. Sometimes the elevator does get stuck. And that photo, though, that you picked out, I love that photo because it almost summarizes the whole experience. You know, you've got this antiquated technology, right? You've got this scary-looking circular ladder. I mean, it looks like you're going down into the abyss when you look down into that hole. And then you've got this, I don't know, it's just a foreboding-looking thing. And if you think about the whole nuclear missile, just the world state of affairs when it comes to that, that photo summarizes pretty well what I felt when I was down there. I remember certain parts of the story I wrote, and part of it was these guys do this hurry up and wait every day. It's hurry up, get out to the silo, get down there into the bunker, watch the screens, and wait. And then they hurry up and they do it again and they do it again and they do it every day. And I think I said in the article that hurry up and wait is a good thing when it comes to this because they've never had to use these missiles. So hurry up and wait. Let those guys hurry up and wait into eternity.
Thinking about this, thinking about the responsibility and what could really happen, and there hasn't been any accidents, is really a testament to them, to everyone who's done this, you know.
That's absolutely right. And again, these kids are 25 and 28 years old.
Amazing.
I mean, that's a lot of responsibility.
Were you able to write about everything you saw on the tour?
I was. They were incredibly transparent. They obviously had a PR guy with us. They had their own photographer. But yeah, everything that I saw, every word of the interview I did with the missileers, I guess the only thing that was a little, and I understand this, after all the photos were taken and we left the silo, we had to go over to a photo cleansing place where they literally looked at every photo to make sure there was nothing proprietary in the photo, any information. And I remember one of the photos, there was a reflection of the screen on my glasses. And they had to take that and Photoshop it out because it could give away some proprietary information. You know, the screens, they wouldn't let us take any pictures of the screens. The other thing is, you know, everything down there is 50s, 60s technology. So it's analog. There's nothing digital. There's no internet. It's all done via cables. You know, it's a good thing in that nobody can hack into it. I mean, it's scary in that you think this technology is so old that, I mean, how can it still work? But it does. So for me, I was surprised by the technology, but when they explained it to me, I was reassured.
You also were very close to a B-52 bomber, and you got a flight on one.
They asked me when I came out if I wanted to stay an extra couple of days to do the B-52 flight, and I thought, of course, when am I going to get another chance to fly in a B-52? So they house a number of the working B-52s out at Minot. There's another area down in, I think it's Louisiana, that houses the rest of them. Yeah, so they offered me a flight. Like the F-15, I had to do some parachute training. I had to have a physical. I had to do some preparation. But once we got in the plane, took off with eight engines, they were kind of laughing, well, if we lose one or two on takeoff, we'll be fine. But anyway, we went up to about 30,000 feet, and it's very cramped aircraft. You'd think because it's so big that there'd be a lot of space in there, but there's not. And I was up there sort of in the jump seat between the two pilots, and one of the pilots, well, the pilot himself, there's a co-pilot and a pilot, said, "Hey, you want to come up here and fly the plane?" First, I thought he was kidding, and I said, "That's okay." And he goes, no, really, do you want to fly the plane?" And I'm not a pilot, but, well, why not? So I got up there into the seat. We exchanged seats, and, of course, there was the co-pilot on my right. He asked me to go ahead and do a left bank. So I took the steering wheel. I turned a little to the left, and the plane, it hesitated for a minute, and I thought, maybe I didn't do something right. But then it started to turn, and I turned a little more, and it started to really bank left. And then when I had to turn it right, straighten the plane out, there was a lag. And they call this driving a bus for a reason. It's like turning a ship around. It's not going to react right away. There's a little lag time. So what you don't want to do is get behind it, turn it too far left or right, and then have to recorrect. But yeah, I was in the pilot seat for about a minute. Had a blast, and when we got down, I told the PR guy about it. The PR guy didn't accompany me in the plane, and he was like, "You're not going to put that in the story, are you?" And I said, "Of course." That's the whole story right there. I got to pilot a B-52.
So you have the training, but piloting the B-52 is not part of the training. These just guys all of a sudden said to you, "Hey, by the way, you want to fly this thing?"
Yeah, I think they got a kick out of it. You know, they're like, "Oh, New York journalist, let's put him in the pilot seat, give him a little fun." And look, we were at 30,000 feet. There was probably no danger. Co-pilot was right over there on the other side with his hands ready to go on the wheel. But how many people can say they've flown a B-52 or even been in a B-52, right?
Only one that I know, you, Jim.
Well, I'm lucky.
I'm just amazed at the size of these things. When you wrote in the article, you know, the wingspan of this is twice the width of my front yard almost. It's like 180 feet, 8 engines. And I think the thing that amazes me the most is that the life expectancy is to 2040 on these things.
Yeah, when Boeing built these things, and they are monsters, you're right, they're monsters. You know, I couldn't even, I had to back up so far to take a picture where the whole plane was in it with the wingspan. It was ridiculous. But yeah, they're supposed to be in operation until 2040. So all you people out there who are listening, you want to find a B-52? Geez, you've got 22 more years at least. And who knows whether they'll refurbish them and keep them flying past that. But yeah, very well-built planes, real workhorses.
You had written something in the article I thought was very special about the servicemen and women. And you said that, "I want to personally thank all who took care of me for three of the best experiences of my life."
Yeah. Look, what these guys do every day, we take for granted. They protect our country. They protect the world. They have very complex jobs with a lot of responsibility, and I felt throughout the whole experience that I was being well taken care of. They called me sir. They called me by my last name, Mr. Clash. It took me a long time to get them just to call me Jim. They have so much respect for what they do, and in fact, they treated me with tremendous respect as a journalist, and I was just amazed by how they take complex things and make them simple, make them look like they're simple to do, and I know damn well that they're not.
It is just amazing that just average people, you know, we don't think about how they risk their lives every day to keep this country safe and to do a job that takes precision and is risky on a daily basis.
Oh, yeah, it's risky. You know, think about these F-15 pilots. It's one thing to fly these things in peacetime, but imagine they're in the Middle East, and the pilot I had fought in the Middle East, and when they have missiles on the wings of these F-15s, you know, it's a whole different deal. We were just having a leisurely Mach 1.1 flight over the ocean off the shores of North Carolina, but imagine if we were in the Middle East and we were firing missiles and being shot at, missiles being fired at us. And again, part of what we did in the F-15 is we had to do some mock military maneuvers with other F-15s. And, of course, we were taking no fire, but imagine if you were. So these guys, they're the right stuff. There's a reason why they call fighter pilots the right stuff. They're just a breed above the rest of us.
Amazing experience. Thanks for sharing it with us.
Oh, no problem. Listen, I'd do it again if they asked me.
Jim, you just got back from drag racing, and you actually went to a drag racing class. Is that correct?
That's right, Andy. I was down at the NHRA ZMAX Charlotte race this past weekend, where I saw the real pros. And if you've never been to a drag race, I suggest you do it once just to see the power involved. These cars are 11,000 horsepower cars. They go from 0 to 300 plus miles an hour in less than 4 seconds. The G-forces on the drivers must be unbelievable. I think they pull 6.5 G's in the middle of their run. And then they pull negative 6 G's when the parachute comes out the back of the car. But yeah, I was down there and watching the pros, hanging with the pros at Don Schumacher Racing. And they were a little bit respectful of me because I had gone to drag racing school. I went to the Frank Hawley Drag Racing School last summer, and I learned how to go, for us, 0 to 160 miles an hour in a little over 8 seconds. But the most interesting part of that statistic is you go from 0 to 60 miles an hour in 1.5 seconds. Now, that's pretty quick for a civilian like me.
I've been in a car myself that I think was pretty close to like 4.5, 5 seconds, 0 to 60. That was pretty darn fast. I can imagine that your head hits the the back of the seat.
Well, no, it's true. You know, people talk about Corvettes and they talk about Lamborghinis and even the Bugatti. And I think the fastest passenger car, maybe it's around 3 seconds, 0 to 60 in 2.8 seconds, the Bugatti Veyron. But this is a whole other level, and it makes it difficult to focus on what you have to do because of the violence of the launch of these cars. But I remember this is one of the few experiences where I was in class, and I was trying to listen to everything we had to do, and it sounded so complicated in class that when we got out to the cars, I went to the instructor and I said, I don't think I can do this. I really don't think I can do this. I can do this story by interviewing the other students. And he looked at me and he says, I think you can do it, Jim. So I did it. And I'm glad I did. But it's not easy. It's very claustrophobic. You must wear a fireproof driving suit, fireproof gloves, helmet, helmet sock, driving shoes. You're strapped in with 5 belts into the cockpit. There are arm restraints that are also strapped in case the car starts to flip. You don't want to cut your arms off. It's a real deal experience when you have to drive that car by yourself. You have to stage it on the starting line. I've driven a lot of things. I've driven Indy cars, NASCAR, stock cars. I drove an F1 car once. I've driven a lot of supercars. But this was different. This was a straight line, and it was in tremendous acceleration. And as I say, I almost didn't do it, but I did, and I'm glad I did.
What I can't fathom is that the professionals go like 0 to 100 miles an hour in like 0.8 seconds. I mean,
that's right. Now, we're 0 to 100 in 0.8 seconds, so less than a second. They go 0 to 200 in less than 2 seconds. They go 0 to 300 in less than 3 seconds. So just imagine what that does to your body in terms of G-force, right?
And trying to keep that thing straight in a straight line at the same time.
Oh, yeah. You know, I was watching from the back. We were on the starting line a couple of times for these races this past weekend, and it is not a straight line. I mean, those cars were fishtailing all over the place. You know, you're in a very narrow lane. You've got to keep that car going straight. The car does not want to go straight. 11,000 horsepower is trying to destabilize that car. I really have a lot of respect for the drivers I saw out there.
I can tell you that every time I talk to you about these experiences, you seem to top them. As you said, you've been in several cars at high speeds, but this sounds like a whole different experience.
It was, and actually this weekend, as part of my baptism by the NHRA, they have an experience called baptism by nitro. These cars run on nitromethane, which is a very acrid-smelling fuel that also causes your eyes to water. And they have this program where they'll put you on the start-finish line. Now, there were 4 cars going off at a time, so you had 44,000 horsepower leaving the starting line at the same time. and they put you in between the four cars on a little bit, it's kind of like a little pedestal where you're up about 3 feet off the ground, so you can really, really feel it and really, really smell the nitromethane. And they put a couple of us on this pedestal, and I've never experienced anything like the sensory overload I experienced there. You see the fire coming out of the cars. You feel in your chest this tremendous wave of sound. You hear this incredible, almost like a rocket launch sound. You know, you can smell the nitromethane. You can taste nitromethane. It is really sensory overload all in the span of like a second as they take off. And my hat actually blew off, even though I had headphones, noise-canceling headphones over the hat. I don't know how it happened, but it did it. That is some serious horsepower when those guys take off.
Yeah, I've been to rocket launches, you know, Jim. I've been to shuttle launches to within 3 miles of a shuttle launch. And, you know, just to feel the ground shake that as that rocket engine points towards you, the rocket engine just blasting sound waves off your chest. But this sounds like you got it beat. What I'm listening to what you're saying is an experience that not too many people get to enjoy, and that's something that beats a rocket launch, I would think.
Well, I have to say, I've never been to a rocket launch. The Air Force has invited me to come down. That's one of the things on my bucket list. But yeah, I think because we're so close, and because this stuff, it's basically like a controlled explosion. I think with a rocket launch, it's a more of a build-up as the thing goes up. These cars just, you know, I mean, it's like an explosion when they take off. So, again, I haven't been to a rocket launch. Looking forward to doing it, but this is something else. If you get a chance, Andy, go down and try it. Compare it to a rocket launch. Tell me what you think.
I'd love to have the opportunity.
just beware. You're really going to smell some pretty nasty fuel as it burns.
My guess is you're going to smell like that nasty fuel when you're done, too.
Well, it's funny, you know, they call them nitromethane freckles. When we were driving back to the hotel, my photographer saw the side of my face and my neck, and she took some pictures because I had all this black freckles that had been produced by the nitromethane fuel and the rubber being burned off the tires. It's violent, let me tell you. It's a violent experience.
Well, I'd like to talk about you being a guest on Star Talk Radio, a guest about the psychology of adventure. What was that like?
Neil deGrasse Tyson, in his wisdom, has done some spinoffs from Star Talk, and one, a new one, is called Playing with Science. So I was a guest on one of the Playing with Science episodes recently, and they wanted me to talk about extreme adventure. But I wasn't just going to talk about extreme adventure, but they had on a sports psychologist, and they had a neurologist. The psychologist was talking about why extreme adventurers do what they do, and the neurologist was talking about what areas of the brain are affected when you do this sort of thing. And it was really interesting. There was a comedian named Chuck Nice who interjected a lot of humor into the episode, and then there was a guy named Gary who had been a professional soccer player, so he really knew the sports side of it. And we had a lot of fun. I mean, I have to say, I didn't know what areas of my brain were being affected. I kind of understood a little bit about the psychology of what I was doing, but I guess people do it for different reasons. And my reason really is I have to write a story about it. So it's a little different than just a pure thrill seeker, I guess.
I think about that when I think about the things that you do. I say to myself, well, is it the experience? Is it getting the article? Is it the competition? Is it the rush? Or is it all of them put together?
Honestly, it's all of them put together. There's a curiosity I've always had. What's it like to drive a car at 200 miles an hour? What's it like to climb the Matterhorn? What's it like to bobsled with the Olympic team? What's it like to fly an F-15? I want to know what that feels like. But at the same time, there is an adrenaline rush, obviously. And, you know, each time you do one of these things, it takes a little more adrenaline the next time to get the same rush. It's like a drug. So you have to be careful how many of these things you do in what time period, otherwise you'll burn yourself out. But the most important thing for me is that as a journalist, I have to write a story about it. And people ask about fear. I always ask my guests about fear. What are they afraid of? How do they handle fear? But for me, there's not a lot of fear involved because I don't know how to explain this, but, you know, there's a lot of actors who are shy. But when they get on stage, they become a different person. They become the character that they're playing. That allows them, it gives them permission to be that outgoing person that they're not. And honestly, I'm just a regular person who is fairly shy. But when I go out there and I'm in that car at 200 or I'm in the F-15, I'm a different person. That's a character I'm playing. That's a guy who's got to write a story. And so it gives me this permission to go do what I'm going to have to do. And while I'm doing it, I really have to think about, how am I going to explain this to my readers? This is not television. This is, well, like we are right now, radio, or it's print. You know, you've got to be able to describe it in such a way that your readers or your listeners are going to understand it. So that's part of it, too. It's just being another person in that car.
I have to ask you a question. You know, we spoke about you doing all these things that are violent, and you had mentioned, again, and I love mentioning this on the show because the most violent thing you said you did was bobsledding. And I'm watching the Winter Olympics this year, and I see people in the skeleton competition. I say, hey, would Jim be interested in doing the skeleton, would you?
Honestly, I'd be more interested in doing the skeleton than I would in the luge. Now, at least in the skeleton, they're facing forward like you would be on a sled when you were a kid. But in the luge, they're upside down, laying on top of each other. I mean, it's crazy. I'm sorry. The difference, I think, in those particular sports and the bobsled is that in the bobsled, you're really being thrown around inside the sled. And, you know, not being a professional, when I did it, I didn't realize you had to keep your head down all the way underneath the lip of the sled. And so my head kept banging into the lip of the sled. Now, obviously, I had on a burn suit. I had on a helmet. But I was almost knocked out a couple of times. I saw stars. So the second time I went down, I knew not to put my head up like that. But still, it is the most violent experience. Maybe that standing on the starting line for that split second with the nitromethane burning top fuel dragsters this past weekend was more violent for that amount of time. But in the bobsled, it was like a controlled violence for 60 seconds. So again, I would say the bobsled is still the most intense thing I've ever done.
60 seconds is a long time for violence compared to 1 second, that's for sure.
Yeah, well, you know, the great hockey player, Chris Chelios, who was the captain of the Detroit Red Wings and also the Olympic team captain, you know, he went down once the same way I did as a break guy on the two-man with a guy named John Napier, who was an Olympian. And he wouldn't go down again. He said the violence in that 60 seconds was akin to the violence of playing a whole hockey game. So compressed into 60 seconds. So that looks easy on TV, but it's not.
I guess that says it all, really. Someone says it's a continual a hockey game in 60 seconds. That's pretty violent.
Yeah, and I mean, this guy's a tough guy. I mean, these hockey guys, you know, they're missing teeth, and I don't know how many concussions they've had, but, you know, he's not a wimp. Chris Chelios is a tough guy. So for him to say that just shows you how violent it really is.
So what do you have on the horizon for future adventures?
Good question. Obviously, there's my Virgin Galactic flight, which that it's now gearing up. Getting excited about that. Let's see, in terms of future stuff, well, we're doing Space Doors at the Explorers Club on October 20th, so we're getting our lineup together for that. And thinking about taking the next level of NHRA drag racing, which would be the top alcohol cars, and they go about 250 miles an hour. I'm working on something with the Air Force where we'll be going up either in a U-2 spy plane or up in a T-38 to service the U-2 while it's in the air. So yeah, I got a lot of stuff on the horizon, excited. And, and there's another thing, if I can mention this. It has nothing to do with cosmic perspectives, but I'm working on a book about 60s rockers. Going to put it out next year under a small publishing press label. But it's interviews with 25 of the great rockers from the 60s and the 60s through the eyes of these guys who lived it. and rocked it. So that's something I'm working on now. I'm actually working on it with a guy named Jeff Notkin, who's famous for being in a series called Meteorite Man on the Discovery Channel.
Yes, and he's a rocker in more than one way. He's
That's right. He's a meteorite rocker. He's a space rock guy, right?
But he's also a punk rocker. I think he's a musician also, correct? When he was younger.
Oh, yeah. Jeff's really into punk rock. And but yeah, actually, I also have a story, speaking about meteorites, I have a story coming out in the Robb Report in one of the next issues where I look at the meteorite market, especially the high end where the Sotheby's and Christie's and where they're having these auctions. And the meteorites are selling for record prices, some of them over $1 million. So it's a very interesting story. I'm a meteorite collector. I have about 8 meteorites that I've purchased and some that I found in Odessa with Jeff. So, yeah, I've got that going on, too.
So you got a piece of Mars and a piece of the moon?
That's right. So the other day I bought a small, very small meteorite from Mars and a very small meteorite from the moon. And I was joking around with someone. I said, yeah, when the package came in the mail, when I opened it up, I had both meteorites in my hand. So I had one from Mars and one from the moon. I was holding both of the meteorites at the same time. So I effectively was holding Mars and the moon at the same time on Earth.
That's an adventure in itself.
It is a psychological adventure.
Jim, thanks again for being with us on Cosmic Perspective Radio. It's always a pleasure to have you.
Listen, I got to say, you know, you do a very relaxed interview. I feel like you're sitting here in my apartment, and I love to do it. So I hope your listeners enjoy it, and I hope we can do it again.
Jim, thanks so much, and I feel the same way. And, you know, you telling me your future adventures, I can't wait to talk about them after they happen. So
me too. I want to talk about them, but I got to get through them first.
Sounds good. Thanks again. Jim Clash, person has one of the coolest jobs in the entire universe. Thanks for being with us, Jim.
Thank you, Andy.
Cosmic Perspective Radio is an Andy Panaros production.